KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. After Ukrainian President Zelensky gets an abrasive reception at the White House, he finds a warmer welcome in London. Britain's Prime Minister is promising support, but can Europe get the U.S. back on board? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How are Democratic-led states preparing to challenge President Trump, who's threatened to pull federal funding if they don't get in line? I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We will ask New York Governor Kathy Hochul. Also, a new Netflix series based on the too-crazy-to-be-true-but-true life of the president of the L.A. Lakers, and a private spacecraft touches down on the moon. It is Monday, March 3rd. On this day in 1991, Rodney King was beaten by L.A. police after a high-speed chase. A bystander's video shown on the news sparked a public outcry. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. European nations are coming to Ukraine's defense following last Friday's fiery meeting between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is working to create a peace deal to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Meanwhile, top Republicans in the U.S. are questioning Zelensky's leadership of Ukraine following Friday's disastrous meeting. But NPR's Luke Garrett reports not all of the GOP is on the same page.
House Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana threw his support of Zelensky into doubt on Sunday. He told NBC News,
"Either he needs to come to his senses and come back to the table in gratitude, or someone else needs to lead the country to do that."
On Friday, following the tense Trump-Zelensky meeting, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina suggested Zelensky should resign or change. But on Sunday, GOP Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma told NBC News he disagrees.
"I'm not interested in calling on the resignation of other world leaders."
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont defended Zelensky outright on NBC News.
"Zelensky is leading a country trying to defend democracy against an authoritarian dictator, Putin, who invaded his country."
Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, Speaker Johnson also criticized Vladimir Putin. Johnson says Putin is dangerous and not to be trusted. Israel is pressuring Hamas to agree to a new variation of the ceasefire agreement with Hamas for Gaza. Hamas has not accepted the change. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf says that now Israel has halted all relief supplies into Gaza.
Israel has stopped the flow of much-needed aid, like food and medical supplies, into the enclave. Israel controls what gets in and out of Gaza, and aid groups have warned that this blocking of aid violates international law. Other Arab countries have condemned it.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting. Israel says the change to the ceasefire calls for the release of more hostages and that it retains the right to go back to war if negotiations fail. Hamas says Israel is working to evade the original agreement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that more than 160 measles cases have been reported across the country this year. NPR's Amy Held reports that most stem from a growing outbreak in West Texas.
Friday, the Texas Capitol confirmed its first measles case in years, an unvaccinated infant in Austin. To the north in Lubbock, Shanae Brown worries for her newborn, too young for the vaccine recommended at 12 months.
"I really want her to have it, especially with the first case of someone dying recently."
Officials confirmed February 26, an unvaccinated child died in the outbreak. In Gaines County, where it started, the kindergarten vaccination rate is around 82%. To protect against outbreaks, the CDC says it should be 95%. Amy Held, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Vatican says that Pope Francis has spent another night in a Rome hospital with good rest. This follows a respiratory crisis last week. Vatican officials say the pontiff is stable and off mechanical ventilation. He is not showing any signs of a new infection. Amid wildfire recovery in Los Angeles, an unconventional romantic comedy drama about a sex worker in New York was the big winner at last night's Academy Awards. Steve Futterman has more.
On a night when there wasn't a clear favorite for Best Picture, there was suspense until the very end when Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal opened the final envelope.
And the Oscar goes to...
Anora.
Honora, the story of an exotic dancer and sex worker who falls in love and marries the son of a Russian oligarch, won Best Picture along with a slew of other awards.
And the Oscar goes to Mikey Madison.
Mikey Madison, who plays the title role, won Best Lead Actress. Sean Baker, the man behind the film, won 4 awards for producer, best director, best original screenplay, and best film editing. Adrian Brody won Best Lead Actor for The Brutalist. Other acting awards went to Zoe Saldana and Kieran Culkin. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the Academy Awards in Hollywood.
A long-distance rower has been rescued off Australia. Aremus Marcus was trying to row by himself across the Pacific Ocean from California. He was days away from completing his 7,500-mile journey to Australia, but he ran into a looming tropical cyclone and had to abandon his journey. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Coming up, President Trump is making clear he wants states to follow his lead on policy, whether they agree with him or not. So how are governors who are not on board going to respond? We'll ask New York's Kathy Hochul. But first, when Ukraine's president visited the White House Friday, it devolved into this.
You're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now.
That's President Trump scolding Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office on Friday.
A day later, though, Zelensky got a very different reception in London.
That you're very, very welcome here in Downing Street. As you heard from the cheers on the street outside.
That's British Prime Minister Keir Starmer welcoming Zelensky and telling him Europe has his back. They were joined yesterday by nearly 20 other global leaders, mostly from Europe, who pledged to work together to stop Russia's war in Ukraine.
And NPR's Lauren Freyer joins us now from London to discuss all this. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
Okay, has Friday's meltdown at the White House spurred Europeans into action?
Well, we're going to have to see whether hugs and cheers outside and words of shock and support translate into action. After this summit, I hopped on the phone with Lord Peter Ricketts. He's a member of the House of Lords, a former UK ambassador to France and NATO, and I asked him to gauge the mood among leaders.
They were glad to be doing something, not just wringing their hands about what looked like a terrible car crash in the Oval Office. And I heard a lot of expressions of determination that Europe must do more.
Europe must do more. So what more do the Europeans say they're going to do?
Well, Britain and France say they're working with Ukraine on their own ceasefire plan, which they'll present to the U.S. It may entail deployment of British peacekeepers. Here's what Prime Minister Starmer said last night.
The UK is prepared to back this with boots on the ground and planes in the air, together with others. Europe must do the heavy lifting.
And by heavy lifting, he means funding Europe's defense. You know, since World War II, the U.S. has basically guaranteed Europe's security. But if that's no longer the priority under President Trump, European leaders say they're going to have to step up. Mm. Starmer has hiked British defense spending. He said other countries have pledged to do the same. Yesterday, Starmer also announced another $2 billion in financing for Ukraine to buy more air defense missiles.
But can Europe do that without U.S. support?
Well, Europe has already actually given more aid to Ukraine than the U.S. has. But in terms of ending the war, they're using the phrase coalition of the willing, and they want it to be backed by the U.S. Prime Minister Starmer is really trying to sell Trump on security guarantees. And I asked Lord Ricketts what that could mean.
You couldn't attack a European force if you were Russia without serious consequences, that the Americans would be there to support their European allies in some form. But I think it's a very long way from any clarity as to what President Trump might be willing to do, and I suspect not very much.
So that's a big question mark. You know, what role the U.S. would play on the ground or in the air over Ukraine, if any, and whether it would be enough for Europeans to feel secure in sending peacekeepers.
Okay, Lauren, so what happens next?
Well, there is a European Union summit later this week. A top EU official, Ursula von der Leyen, says she'll unveil plans there for the rearming of Europe. You know, as you know, there's no Europe-wide military. Countries have their own armies.
Right.
Most are also part of NATO. But coordination among them could be a challenge. And leaving London last night, von der Leyen said the goal is to turn Ukraine into a, quote, steel porcupine that is indigestible for potential invaders. And by invaders, of course, she means Russia.
NPR's Lauren Freyer with The View from Europe. Thank you, Lauren.
You're welcome.
With Republicans in control of the White House and both houses of Congress, many of those who don't agree with their direction are looking to Democratic governors to fight back. And Trump is not being shy about punching back on them, like when he called out Maine's Governor Janet Mills last month over transgender policy during a meeting with governors at the White House.
Your population doesn't want men playing in women's sports, so you better comply because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding.
See you in court.
Every state, good, I'll see you in court. I look forward to that. That should be a real easy one.
The Trump administration is also demanding that New York scrap a hard-fought congestion pricing program that just started in January. It uses higher tolls to reduce traffic into a big part of Manhattan and raise money for transit improvements. The administration says they want it ended by March 21st. New York's Governor Kathy Hochul is on the line with us now to talk about that and some other things. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. So you were at that session at the White House that we just mentioned, but you also met with the president to defend the congestion pricing plan. Did you think you were making any headway?
Well, I have to be in the fight no matter what. I mean, they may think they have the power over states. And let me just make an observation here. The federal administration believes that states should be controlling women's bodies. They should be the ones who decide whether or not there's reproductive rights in individual states. We've seen that New York will retain its rights. Other states have lost them. So when it comes to controlling bodies, it's all about the states. When it comes to controlling traffic, they're saying New York as a state, I can't make those decisions. I can't implement laws that were put in place by duly elected officials. So this is where the conflict comes in, and we will fight back hard. I mean, it's very early in the administration. We offered up an olive branch, we'll work with you on infrastructure. Let's redo Penn Station. There's areas where common ground. But once you draw first blood on us, you know, we're coming back hard. And I will be leading the resistance on policies like these where you're hurting New Yorkers directly. This is our decision, not yours.
Are you talking with fellow governors about a united strategy to counter initiatives like this, where, again, you know, federal funding is being threatened? Is there some sort of coherent strategy among all of you?
Well, there's many conversations. Each state has its own fight to take, but there's something that's overarching, which is cuts to Medicaid. Every single state, based on what the Republicans in the House voted on just a few days ago, is devastating to our rural hospitals and a place like St. Mary's Healthcare, where I visited yesterday with Congresswoman Grace Meng and Congressman Greg Meeks to talk about how these medically challenged kids, the sickest of the sick, are going to lose Medicaid if the Republicans from New York and elsewhere have their way. And I came out strong against them. And I said, how dare you do something that's going to hurt these little children? Come here yourselves. Look them in the eyes. Look at their parents' eyes and see the suffering and tell them that you're willing to cut a program that keeps their babies alive. So this is where Democratic governors We know how strong we need to be, and this moment calls for all of us to be the firewall to stand against this destruction of policies that are helping people and have been in place for decades and decades.
Is that your primary mode of resistance, to call attention to the suffering that will ensue, or are there other strategies?
Oh, no, there's many ways. We are in litigation since day one. Our Attorney General Tish James and I work closely together, and this is where governors and attorneys general are all working together. So much of it starts in court, and we were able to successfully work together in litigation to at least temporarily stop a lot of the firings.
Well, that's one of the points, though. There are a number of lawsuits all around the country, but some of them have been successful in instituting temporary restraining orders, and some of them have not. So what then? If these firings are already taking place, what then? And services are compromised.
Right. No, I will say this, there's not a lot of great options. I mean, we have a Republican White House, Republican Senate, and Republican House of Representatives. But elections come around very quickly, and it is our job to fight back in court, resist the way we are on congestion pricing. Each individual policy demands a different response. But overall, this changes in 2026, when we work so hard here in New York and elsewhere to make Hakeem Jeffries the Speaker of the House. And then, just like when I was in Congress, when the Tea Party took over, Republicans controlled the House, but we had the Senate to stop the crazy stuff from happening. We need one of the houses.
Well, that's not the case now. Before we let you go, Governor, I just have to ask, your predecessor, Andrew Cuomo, who resigned, and now he's announcing a run for mayor. You were once running mates in his race for governor. What do you make of his attempt at a comeback? Is he the right person at the right time for this job?
Listen, anybody who wants to run for office can do so. But my focus is not on politics. I will work with a mayor. I work with Bill de Blasio. I work with Eric Adams. I'll work with anyone who wants to continue my policies to make sure we keep the city safe and strong.
That is the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul. Governor, thank you so much for joining us. I do hope we'll talk again.
Certainly. Thank you.
We're remembering singer-songwriter Angie Stone this morning. The Grammy-nominated R&B artist who died in a car accident on Saturday was an important voice in the neo-soul movement and a hip-hop pioneer.
Born in Columbia, South Carolina, she honed her powerful voice as a young girl singing in the church choir. She spoke to NPR's Jesse Thorne in 2023.
In elementary school, I knew then that I wanted to be a singer. I stayed in the mirror doing this, you know. In my mind, it was a no-brainer. This is what I was born to do.
In her teens, she helped form the group The Sequence, one of the first all-female groups to record a hit rap single.
But Stone found her sweet spot in the early 2000s as neo-soul began to dominate R&B.
Yeah, I ended up becoming successful or getting my best, you know, foot forward at a later age in the game.
Her first album, Black Diamond, spawned the hit No More Rain in This Cloud, which stayed at number one on Billboard's Adult R&B Airplay chart for 10 weeks in 1999. Spring has
come, and winter's gone, my love. And in 2001, her album, Mahogany Soul, went gold.
The second single on that album, Wish I Didn't Miss You, climbed to the top of Billboard's Dance Club charts.
Angie Stone was 63. This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, how life can change in a second. Writer Hanif Qureshi's first film, 1985's My Beautiful Laundrette, starred Daniel Day-Lewis and won Qureshi an Oscar for Best Screenplay. In 2022, he fell, and when he regained consciousness, his limbs were paralyzed. We'll talk about life before and after the fall. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. You know how sometimes your life can get so weird that it almost feels like a comedy? Well, that occurred to Jeannie Buss as her brothers were trying to get her fired. Buss is the president of the Los Angeles Lakers, and her life is parodied in a new Netflix comedy called Running Point, starring Kate Hudson.
I work in a family business, which normally, why would you care? But our business is the greatest basketball franchise in the history of the game.
Before his death in 2013, Jeannie's father, Jerry Buss, owned the Lakers. He put her in charge of the business side of things and her brother, Jim, in charge of player personnel. Then the team started losing a lot. Jeannie Buss says that after Kobe Bryant retired, Jim made the decision to let the team fail, basically, so they could stock up on higher draft picks.
My brother and I were butting heads because I kept saying, you know, I can't raise ticket prices if we're not winning. And we just went season after season after season. And I'm like, I've lost patience with this. And my dad explained it to me very well. He put me ultimately in charge.
Right.
He told me, Jeannie, you have the hammer and I expect you to use it. And I had to make the very tough decision to let my brother go. You know, within a season, we attracted the biggest free agent there was, LeBron James, to come and play for the Lakers in 2018.
Yeah. So it was in 2017, that's when you fired your brother. And then he and your older brother, Johnny, tried to have you removed.
Yeah.
You fought back and got lifetime operational control of the Lakers. That brings us to Running Point on Netflix. Kate Hudson plays Isla Gordon, who is essentially you, and the only sister of three brothers who run the LA Waves pro basketball team. In the series, Isla's older brother, Cam, is the Waves president. He has to go to rehab and then makes Isla president. I almost keep wanting to say makes you president because the similarities are so right there. So in this clip that we're about to hear, Isla's best friend, Allie, overhears it.
I can't believe it. You are the president of the Waves. This is shocking.
Shocking? That sounds bad.
No, this is good shocking. I love you and you are going to kill this. So you can never f up.
What?
Oh, you know, when a guy gets a big job, he can f up a bunch and it's them getting their sea legs. But women have to be perfect right off the bat.
I am still in celebratory mode.
As you should be. But on behalf of all women, don't ever make a mistake. What's bad for all of us?
So, G, how much of that did you actually feel when you became Lakers president?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the pressure is enormous in terms of becoming a role model. That wasn't ever my intention in doing the job that I do, but I felt an enormous pressure not to fail and feeling that there was probably a lot of people that wanted to see me fail.
Only just because you're a woman?
Just because I'm a woman in this business. And I think, you know, in some ways it was easier to be a woman because, I never intimidated anybody. So people didn't have their guard up when I was around. So I think people, you know, probably told me more things than they should because they were like, oh, she's a girl.
What's she going to do with this
information? Exactly. Yeah. So, but, you know, once you start winning, once we won a championship, I think that that kind of went out the window. Hopefully, now, right? I'm competition.
Yeah. So a little later in that episode, Isla sits down with her older brothers, Drew, the CFO of the team, and Ness, the general manager.
I know Cam's choice came as a surprise, but I can't do this without you guys.
Sis, we got your back.
Thank you.
Yeah, no matter what people say, we got you.
What are they saying?
Don't go on Reddit unless you want to kill yourself.
What?
It's okay. It's okay. Just a bunch of stupid, ugly about the fact that you're a Nepo baby and you don't know what you're doing, but you're old, so it's like you're like a Nepo crone.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Look, it doesn't matter, okay? It's garbage.
Do I look that old?
Nobody cares. The point is...
So I was the Lakers pre- and post-game show host during this time. During all of this going down, I'm taking calls night after night about you and... Is she going to do a good job? How much of that did you hear? How much of that just like, great, what is this, as they say, Nepo baby doing in charge of this precious Lakers franchise?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that I just avoided social media, because you can't really avoid it. You know, I kind of put it in its place. It was important for me to hear and made me work even harder.
There's one other clip from the first episode that really struck me. So this is not long after Isla becomes president. Her brothers try to pressure her into signing off on a player trade that they had put together.
The thing is, we kind of need to hurry, because Miami wants the Travis trade done before their next road trip. So can you just please get on board with the plan?
You don't even have to understand it. You just need to sign.
Fine. I'll do it. Because that's what you want, right?
Yeah.
For me to... shut up and do whatever you tell me. Because I'm just Isla Gordon, stupid and slow and incapable of decision making.
Yeah, when I hear that clip, it really gets me angry still to this day. Like, the character's completely correct, you know, that people want you to just sign your name, like you don't really understand it, pat your head. And, you know, let the real people who understand this stuff
or
make
let
decisions.
The men make the decision.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I could see it in your face. Yeah. Jeanine. I mean, hearing that, I'm sure you heard it over and over again.
It's demoralizing. It really is. Yeah.
To have someone on screen that essentially is a mirror for you. I mean, how does that feel? I mean, while you're watching it.
I mean, it isn't me, but this is more me than what people see every day about me, the humor in it, you know, the crazy stuff that happens. But the thing is that the majority of businesses in this country are family-owned businesses, and everybody has a family. And if you're in business with them, these are the kind of things that happen. But at the end of the day, what brings you together is the team. And it's just figuring out how to not step on each other's toes. And try to coexist.
And laugh, too.
Yeah, and laugh.
Laugh a little bit.
You
too,
have
yeah.
to laugh.
That's Lakers president Jeanine Buss. She's also co-executive producer of the Netflix comedy Running Point, now streaming on Netflix. Jeanine, thanks for stopping in.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
What happens when a lifelong dream comes true, then slips through your fingers? Olympic gymnast Jordan Chiles knows what that feels like. She won an individual bronze medal in Paris. Just days later, it was revoked.
I felt like every single time I would accomplish something, something would be stripped away from me.
I'm Juana Summers. Jordan Chiles on her new memoir, I'm That Girl, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. President Trump will give an address to a joint session of Congress tomorrow night. We have a preview from NPR's Mara Liasson.
New presidents often use these big set-piece speeches to Congress to lay out their agenda, but Trump has already done that.
In just a little over a month, he's shaken up American politics. He's well on his way to drastically shrinking the federal government and dismantling the administrative state. And he's upended world politics by breaking with America's erstwhile allies and pressuring Ukraine instead of Russia. When he speaks to Congress this week, Trump is expected to talk about his victory in November and his plans for tax cuts and more deregulation. He'll also talk about how he's ended DEI and had the most productive 5 weeks in American history. Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin will give the Democratic response. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
President Trump is preparing to deliver his address as European leaders are rallying support for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer hosted a summit meeting in London over the weekend and outlined a plan to bring the war to an end. Amid tensions over the fate of the ceasefire deal in Gaza, police in northern Israel say they're treating the stabbing death of a man in his 60s as a terrorist attack. Four others were wounded in the incident at a bus station in the city of Haifa. Authorities say the assailant was killed by security guards. You're listening to NPR News. A new survey of business economists finds deep skepticism of President Trump's trade policy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the findings from the National Association for Business Economics.
The association surveyed more than 150 business economists and found widespread concern that taxing imports from Mexico, Canada, and China will lead to slower growth in the U.S. and higher inflation. Most of the economists surveyed want to see more free trade agreements, not backsliding on existing deals. Just 2% of those polled back President Trump's call for a 25% tariff on imports from the country's northern and southern neighbors. Nearly 7 out of 10 economists warn the president's tax and spending policies will lead to a larger federal deficit. Survey participants overwhelmingly said the president should play no role in steering the Federal Reserve's policy on interest rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Vatican says Pope Francis no longer needs a mechanical ventilation mask to help him breathe. In the latest update on the Pope's health, the Vatican says Francis rested well overnight and is in stable condition. Following that respiratory crisis last week, Francis was taken to a hospital in Rome earlier this month with respiratory problems that developed into double pneumonia. Director Sean Baker made some history at last night's Academy Awards. His film, Anora, won 5 Oscars, including Best Picture. 4 of them went to Baker, making him the first person to win 4 Oscars for one film. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says that if international students participated in what he calls pro-jihadist protests, then the administration will, quote, find you and we will deport you, unquote. Since his comments about a month ago, NPR's Tovia Smith reports that some say the threat is getting real.
Student activists are especially anxious about two of Trump's executive orders, one on national security and another on combating anti-Semitism. Both target foreigners who, quote, espouse hateful ideologies or support U.S.-designated terrorist groups like Hamas or Hezbollah. The orders demand stricter enforcement of immigration laws so that no such individual could get or keep a visa.
We're getting into a dangerous territory here.
Abed Ayyub, head of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, says he's heard from at least a dozen students who left the U.S. for winter break and were unable to return because their visas were canceled with no explanation given.
Two of them have no involvement at all with student activism on campus. They just happen to be from Gaza. And it should be a concern of all Americans because this opens the door to really criminalizing any speech and any expression in the nation.
The State Department declined to confirm any cases of visas being canceled, citing confidentiality. A spokesman offered only that generally visas are revoked for those who pose a threat to public safety or national security. Ayyub says, meantime, hundreds of students have already called asking how to protect themselves. Some are laying low, while others anxiously venture out.
I was a little scared that I would get, like, photographed or something, and that would cause a problem.
This student asked that her name not be used for fear of jeopardizing her visa status. Some of her friends are skipping events like this Palestine Night fundraiser at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, but she was determined to come.
I feel like college is the time when we should be able to, like, speak freely, and, like, I've been raised with the values that I should be vocal about what I believe in. So it, like, almost feels like I'm lying to myself when I can't say what I feel.
Trump's directive requires schools to monitor their foreign students and staff and report what he calls Hamas sympathizers or pro-jihadists. Schools contacted by NPR either didn't respond or said only that they're still reviewing the order. Meantime, pro-Israel groups say they're fielding a growing number of tips about possible supporters of Hamas and Hezbollah, and it's all leaving many on campus worried Trump's orders are a thinly veiled attempt to silence any Palestinian advocacy.
Their main target is anyone who supports Palestine in any way, shape, or form. Those are the people they're going to target.
This student, an American citizen born to Palestinian parents, asked not to be named for fear of harassment. He says his friends on student visas are terrified that even an old post or photo could come back to haunt them.
One of my friends actually was, like, texting me frantically. I think it was, like, 12 or 1 in the morning. Like, his face was in one of those posts, and he was texting me, like, you know, is there a way we can take this off? Can we get this post removed? And that kind of hit me. I was like, oh, like, this is serious.
Some college newspapers are hearing the same concerns, so much so that the student newspaper at Purdue University decided to give blanket anonymity to all students at all pro-Palestinian protests and even scrubbed all protesters' names and photos from its archives. Maya Stamen, a pro-Israel student from UMass Amherst, is among those concerned that will make it tough to hold protesters accountable. Of course, she says the order must be implemented thoughtfully. Students demanding humanitarian aid in Gaza or criticizing Israel or waving a Palestinian flag, for example, are not the issue, she says. But she's seen some protesters openly supporting U.S.-labeled terrorist groups, and that needs to be addressed.
They were wearing, like, Hamas-like uniforms with the headbands, and there were intifada signs everywhere, like, go Hamas, pro-Hamas stuff. They were just saying this stuff straight up to our face.
I think it's much more common than you might imagine that there are people who are actually coordinating with Hamas, that they're acting as the PR agents of Hamas.
Attorney Mark Goldfeder heads the National Jewish Advocacy Center and has filed a federal lawsuit alleging student groups' ties to terrorists.
They're saying we are Hamas and we want to do these things. It behooves us to believe them and to take precautions for our national security. And you don't even have to like the Jews to worry about it, because they're coming for the United States as well.
Ultimately, any effort to deport a student for protest activity is all but certain to be challenged. Georgetown Law Professor David Cole, formerly with the ACLU, says it's unlikely to pass constitutional muster.
The government would have a huge First Amendment hurdle to overcome if it sought to go after someone for their pure speech. And if it were enforced, it would be, I believe, struck down.
But another staunch free speech proponent, Elia Shapiro of the Manhattan Institute, disagrees.
It's not about policing or prosecuting speech. It's about enforcing immigration regulations. And immigration regulations say that if you espouse support for certain groups that are inimical to the American interest, then you don't get a visa. Or if you're here already, then your visa gets revoked.
Meantime, pro-Palestinian students are left contemplating their risk. Some, like this 27-year-old grad student from the West Bank, who asked that his name not be used for fear of being targeted, says he will continue to speak out.
I mean, my people are being slaughtered there and dehumanized. I'm not going to just sit down there and just be afraid of speaking up, no matter what the consequences are.
Still, he did reach out to a free speech advocacy group to make sure he's got help lined up just in case, as he put it, someone wants to get rid of him. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
A private company is claiming a new milestone in space exploration history. Firefly Aerospace says it's the first commercial company to execute a fully successful soft landing on the moon. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports it's part of NASA's push to rely more on the private sector.
It was just past 3:30 a.m. Sunday morning when the Blue Ghost lunar lander made its final approach. A live stream of the landing showed a subdued mission control room until Chief Engineer Will Coogan came over the speaker to announce the craft had touched down.
IE reports lunar gravity and it is stable.
Paul Kahn, Chief Engineer on Ops. Y'all suck the landing. We're on the moon.
The mission was part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services Initiative. The space agency has been contracting with private companies to send scientific instruments and other technology to the moon. Dr. Nikki Fox is Associate Administrator of NASA's Science Mission Directorate.
We want to build a sustainable economy, space economy for the U.S., inspiring these U.S. companies to step forward and take on these challenges and support NASA to do great things.
Just 1 year after a different American firm's lunar craft landed on the moon and then tipped over on its side, Firefly Aerospace said Sunday that Blue Ghost touched down smoothly.
We didn't have to abort any burns. We didn't have to recycle. We didn't have to go around the moon another time. It went extremely well.
Ray Allensworth is spacecraft program director at the Texas-based company. She says Blue Ghost quickly got to work conducting the NASA experiments that were on board.
There's no break for those console operators. We've already begun moving into surface commissioning and getting started on those payload operations.
Among the 10 NASA payloads are a drill to measure lunar heat flow, an instrument to collect rock samples, and an X-ray imager to study Earth's magnetic field. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Every day, more than 100,000 flights take off and land at airports around the world. What if you could harness all the wind from the jet engines idling on the tarmac? That's next time on Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Emporia, Kansas may soon be flooded with superfans of its water. The city took the top tap water prize last month in the 35th annual Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting. There were categories for bottled, purified, and sparkling water as well. Waters were judged on appearance, odor, mouthfeel, and aftertaste. Afterwards, fans thirsty for a sip of greatness rushed the stage to grab surplus bottles. Drink responsibly. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump addresses a joint session of Congress tomorrow. It typically starts with something along the lines of the State of the Union is strong, but Americans are saying it isn't. That is one finding from the latest NPR PBS News Marist poll out today. Joining us to tell us more about it is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michelle.
So a technical detail for the nerds, you know, a president's first address to a joint session of Congress is not technically called a State of the Union address, even though it does feel like one. All right. So having said that, what is the mood overall in the U.S.?
Well, the big picture here is that Trump starts with a 45% approval rating, which is higher than when he left office, but lower than for any president in the last 80 years, except for the very similar rating he got when he came into office in 2017. A slim majority, 53%, says the State of the Union is not strong, and a similar 54% say the country is off on the wrong track. Now, those numbers are actually improvements from the last couple of years, but it's mainly due to enthusiasm with Republicans who, you know, like a lot of what Trump is doing. But 3/4 of Democrats and 2/3 of independents said the country is not doing well and are largely not supportive of many of the things Trump is trying to do. There are real warning signs in this survey for Republican elected officials with how independents are viewing things, and we know they often decide elections.
Okay, so let's talk for a minute about one of Trump's biggest initiatives, DOGE, which is working to cut the federal workforce. How are people viewing, first of all, like how fast it's happening, and secondly, what's actually being done?
Yeah, well, number one, people think that Trump's moving too fast in making these changes. They think that he's doing it without considering their impact. 56% said that, including, again, 2/3 of independents. Republicans, on the other hand, approve and think that the changes are necessary. DOGE itself is not very popular. That's the informal, you know, advisory department of government efficiency headed by Elon Musk. Just 39% have a favorable opinion of it. Musk himself gets the same rating, and that's unchanged from January. And I'm not sure views of Musk can go much lower because he does have a lot of Republican support.
This poll also took the country's temperature on foreign policy and the economy. So what did you find there?
Well, the economy and prices were big reasons, obviously, that Trump won. But almost 6 in 10 in this survey think that prices are going to go up in the next 6 months. Only about 4 in 10 think Trump's approach will make the economy better. When it comes to foreign policy, just 44% think that Trump's approach is going to make things better. On Ukraine, 2/3 think that the U.S. is either not giving enough support or is giving about the right amount. We should say that this poll was conducted last week, just before that contentious Oval Office meeting between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. On both the economy and foreign policy, independents, again, think Trump is making things worse by 20 points. And with all of what's happening in the past month, there's been a tremendous erosion of faith in the system of checks and balances in the country. Just 43% think it's working well, down 23 points from December.
You know, just you just mentioned this. Look, it is still early, and a lot has already gone on. So what could all of this mean politically?
Well, obviously, Trump is barred from running again, so it's down-ballot Republicans who are the ones who are likely to feel the success or fallout of this administration's policies in the next year and how voters feel about that. You know, Republican voters appear to be in lockstep with Trump, but this survey tells us there's not much beyond that for Trump. And if independents continue to disapprove and the strong Democratic opposition holds up, that really could spell trouble for Republicans in next year's midterms.
That is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. A new NPR investigation has found problems with the system for policing bad behavior by federal judges and a pervasive culture of fear about blowing the whistle.
Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson interviewed dozens of people who worked in the judicial branch, and she's here now to talk more about what she's uncovered.
A warning, this investigation and Carrie's reporting mentions sexual assault. Carrie, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Leila.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about the scope of what you found and when you started looking into this.
I've worked on this project for nearly a year. I talked with 42 people who are current or former employees of the federal courts, everyone from law clerks to court reporters to people in probation and public defender offices. They told me about bad experiences with more than two dozen judges. Those judges represent both major political parties. They're men and women who work all over the country.
Okay, bad experiences. That's pretty broad. I mean, what were the common themes you heard in talking with all sorts of people?
Well, let's start with the idea that the relationship between a federal judge and a law clerk can be pretty imbalanced. Mm-hmm. Judges have the power to make or break the career of a young lawyer with only a phone call or two. People told me they were afraid to report bullying or harassment by federal judges because the internal systems are so complicated, the consequences for them are huge, and there's really no guarantee those people can remain anonymous.
Did you get some former clerks to share their stories? What stands out to you about them?
Yes, I spoke with a former law clerk in Alaska. She moved there in 2020, and she had hoped the clerkship would jumpstart her career in the law. She was afraid to talk on tape, so we found a voice actor to share her words verbatim.
The judge was the HR department. The judge was my boss. The judge was a colleague. The judge was everything. He had all the power.
Wow.
That judge, Joshua Kindred, began to text her constantly, sometimes really personal things. And after she left her clerkship, she said he sexually assaulted her. The judge later said the encounter was consensual and said he had no, quote, sinister intent. Eventually, a court investigation found he created a hostile work environment for his clerks and had an inappropriately sexualized relationship with one of them. That judge resigned last July.
So what are the federal courts saying about what you found in this investigation?
The administrative office of the courts helps set policy for the court system and handles all kinds of administrative tasks. They said the changes they put in place since the Me Too scandals in 2017 are real and that they're working. Mm. They say they're continuing to make improvements and more people are using their systems to complain. But few of those complaints are actually about judges who behave badly. People who follow this system tell me those numbers are low because clerks are afraid to complain about judges and sometimes because clerks are discouraged from filing any paperwork at all.
But then you have a lot of these young clerks that you spoke to that feel unprotected. Are there any efforts to change the system?
There are some. Democrats in the U.S. House, like Norma Torres of California and Hank Johnson of Georgia, have been pushing for some change. Their bill to give judicial workers more legal protection died last year without any action from Congress.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm sure we'll hear more of your reportings and your findings in the weeks and months ahead.
Thanks for having me.
We humans express our grief in many different ways. Last night in Washington, D.C., it looked like figure skating. The nation's best figure skaters delivered a tribute to victims of January's plane crash, which took place just outside D.C. More than two dozen of those on board were young figure skaters, their families, and coaches. NPR's Becky Sullivan has this report.
Some of the most recognizable names in American figure skating were part of the show on Sunday night. Christy Yamaguchi, Nancy Kerrigan, Nathan Chen, Johnny Weir, and so too were members of what's likely to be the U.S. team at next year's Winter Olympics. But none of them could match the emotion of 13-year-old figure skater Isabella Aparicio. Aparicio lost her older brother Franco and her father Luciano on American Eagle Flight 5342 back in January. She skated last night to a recording of her father playing Pachelbel's Canon. She knelt on the ice and put her face in her hands as the tears came, and the crowd of 15,000 people stood to applaud her. her dad and brother were traveling home from a youth development camp that had followed the U.S. Figure Skating Championships in Wichita. Their plane was on its final approach when it and a military helicopter collided in midair. All 67 people aboard the two craft were killed. Nearly a dozen of them were young skaters who'd been at the camp. The oldest was 16, the youngest just 11. All of them were traveling with at least one parent. The world of elite figure skating isn't especially big, and the news shocked people deeply.
It was a very traumatic experience for me and really just devastating for me to hear.
Ilya Malinin is one of the biggest stars in the sport right now. He had just won the men's national title in Wichita, but had already come home to Virginia when he heard about the crash. He had to step away from skating altogether for a few days, he said. Being from the D.C. area, the 20-year-old knew several of the victims, even though they were younger than him.
They would stop by my home rink to just skate around when all the other ice rinks didn't have ice time. And it was really fun for me to see them, you know, get on the ice and be passionate about their sport.
Four coaches were on the plane, too, including the husband and wife pair Vadim Nomov and Jenya Shishkova. Their 24-year-old son, Max, is a talented figure skater himself. He placed fourth at the championships 3 days before the crash. Last night, he carried two white roses out to the ice to begin his routine. Sequins on his maroon shirt glittered in the spotlight as he performed. He finished with a turn into a kneel, then he sobbed. The performances of Nomov and Isabella Aparicio stuck with Sam Aksher, the president and acting CEO of U.S. Figure Skating.
I don't know how they did it. I mean, both of them, the emotion you could see, the passion you could see, the feeling for their loved ones that they lost.
It was an amazing moment, he said. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.